Welcome to The Point. I'm Indy Todd. Today, books set on or about the Cape Coast and Islands. And with us is Jill Erickson, reference librarian at Falmouth Public Library. Good morning, Jill.
Good morning, Mindy.
And naturalist Dennis Minsky. Good morning, Dennis.
Good morning, Mindy. Good morning, Jill.
And Dennis, I have to say, it's lovely to hear your voice, even though you're on the other end of Cape Cod this morning.
I am indeed. Ensconced in my bedroom.
I'm in the basement.
I'm actually in the living room, so I'm doing okay. Although there is a Zoom conversation going on in, you know, the next room over, but other than that.
Yeah, so funny. I'm curious to see what books you have, because there's so much you could choose from in this category. So, Jill, start us off.
Well, I have to say, every time we do a Cape and Island show, which we try to do every so often, I'm just, like, bowled over by how much great writing there is and how much new there is that comes out every year. And because it is, we're, you know, heading into high tourism season, I've brought books both for those who have been here forever and those who might just have arrived. And one of the real surprises that I found in looking for books was something called A Field Guide to Cape Cod, including Nantucket, Martha's Vineyard, Block Island, and Eastern Long Island by Patrick J. Lynch. It's published by Yale University Press, and you might say, why on earth do we need, you know, yet another field guide to Cape Cod and the islands? But this is wonderful. It came out in 2019, and as it says in its preface here, the book is a general introduction to the natural history of the ocean-facing coasts of southeastern New England and Long Island, with an emphasis on environments, not on particular locations. And what he goes on to do is he has sort of little essays about every sort of thing that happens on Cape Cod. So there's a section on beaches. There's a section on weather and water. He talks about terminology, which is actually really funny, about how people describe Cape Cod. And as any of you who have lived here any amount of time, I know when I first moved here, I was completely confused about what the Lower Cape, Upper Cape, and Mid Cape were. But he writes, even the proudest Cape residents will admit that Cape Cod regional terminology is both confused and confusing. The local terms for parts of the Cape are a jumble of early colonial terms and old sailor slang, when down meant downwind and lower meant, well, whatever the speaker understood it to mean, regardless of how unhelpful the word might be to outsiders. So let's at least be consistent within these pages. I've laid out the regions of Cape Cod in the figure at right, mostly drawn from current usage in the Cape Cod real estate industry. When I refer to the outer lands, I mean the whole region. When I'm referring just to Cape Cod and the nearby islands of Nantucket, Martha's Vineyard, and smaller islands like the Elizabeth Islands, I'll call them the Cape and Islands. So it's so fascinating that, I mean, then it's true, you know, just the names everybody uses. But you also find, and he's got this great section on, it's filled with photos as well and charts. He has weather, as I said, and water, beaches. He starts, beaches are rough and turbulent places built and eroded by winds, waves, and coastal currents. For plants, beaches and are dry as deserts and sprayed with blasts of sand and salt. So he's a lovely writer as well as giving you a lot of information. And I suspect anybody, well, almost anybody, we do have a lot of scientists in town, so probably not everybody, but lots of people will discover things, words they didn't know before. For example, in the beaches section, I'm sure Dennis probably already knows this, but there is something called rack lines, W-R-A-C-K.
Yeah, of course.
Of course. See, this is what I mean. you've done your reading. Rack lines provide food and shelter for many small beach organisms, including beach fleas, small crabs, wolf spiders, many other kinds of spiders. Rack lines also trap and hold windblown sand on beaches. I had not heard the expression rack lines, so I at least learned something from this book. But I do think anybody, if whether you're a tourist or you've been here a long time, this is real. Oh, and he also has pictures of all kinds of animal tracks, so you can find out what animal you're looking
at.
Oh, that's
fun.
Yeah. So it's Cape Cod, and the guidebook is by Patrick J. Lynch.
Ooh, sounds interesting. Dennis, what have you got?
Well, I agree with Jill. I have a stack of books here, and I could go on for hours. I conferred with friends, including Margaret Murphy and Liz Bradfield, and I am going to, if I get a chance, talk about the first three books I'd like to talk about are really foundational. That is, if you are a reader, and if you are interested in Cape Cod, and I imagine that includes everyone listening, these books you should have read or even reread. Yes, everybody knows about them, but they need to be revisited. So the first one, of course, is Cape Cod, Henry David Thoreau.
See, I knew you were going to bring that, so I didn't bring it. I'm so glad you did.
Well, I have two more that are line up right behind him. But at any rate, this book is, as I say, foundational. It's a travel book. The edition I'm reading was has an introduction by our own Robert Finch. It's a travel book. It's a record of a time, a place, and a people that is invaluable. It's also a record of the man himself, and what a quirky, interesting, funny guy he was. Now, when he visited Cape Cod three times to write this book, he did bypass the tonier towns, and he focused more on the less developed areas. He talks about the desolate plains of East Ham. He talks about Provincetown not being so much a town but an inhabited beach. And he mostly focused on the ocean and the outer beach. And in a very famous passage, he describes it as, "It is a wild, rank place, and there is no flattery in it. Strewn with crabs, horseshoes, and razor clams, and whatever the sea casts up, a vast morgue where famished dogs may range in packs, and crows come daily to glean the pittance which the tide leaves them." Probably in the rack line, Jill. "The carcasses of men and beasts together lie stately up upon its shelf, rotting and bleaching in the sun and waves, and each tide turns them in their beds and tucks fresh sand under them. There is naked nature, inhumanly sincere, wasting no thought on man, nibbling at the cliffy shore where gulls wheel amid the spray." But it's not all bleak. He can be very, very funny. He makes a reference to the fact that until recently, recently being 1864, there were no lawyers on Cape Cod below Orleans. And then he says, "Who then will complain of a few regular man-eating sharks along the backside?" You know, very wry humor. But in a bit of a prophecy, you know, he talks about how inaccessible the town is. "The places which I've described may seem strange and remote to my townsmen. Indeed, from Boston to Provincetown is twice as far as from England to France. Yet step into the cars, and in 6 hours, you may stand on those four planks." That's Commercial Street. 6 hours, how about that? And wow. Finally,
well, some years it could take that long to cross the bridge.
Yeah, right.
Well,
there is traffic. Yeah.
But finally, he says, "The time must come when this coast will be a place of resort for those New Englanders who really wish to visit the seaside. At present, it is wholly unknown to the fashionable world, and probably it will never be agreeable to them."
Well, isn't
about
that funny?
This weekend, huh?
Yeah.
Anyhow, Cape Cod, it's worth a visit or a revisit. It really is. So that's my first contribution.
First pick. All right, Jill.
Oh, Dennis, that was great. I'm so glad you brought that, and what beautiful pieces you read. Everyone should read or reread that. Another book I brought along, which I have to say, I think in part I brought this along because we happen to be, you know, still in a pandemic, and this has some great things to do with kids in it. And it, in fact, is about beaches in England. I have to, this is a disclaimer, this is actually about beaches in England. However, the book is so beautiful, I had to bring it along. It's called An Illustrated Coastal Year, The Seashore Uncovered Season by Season. And one of the fabulous things about it are these little projects that they have. And these projects can be done if you're at an English beach or if you're on a Cape Cod beach. For example, she shows you how to make a fish bracelet and earrings from watercolor paper. She makes spoons out of shells. She has a recipe for crab cakes. She has a design for a driftwood candelabra. To make your barbecue special. But she also, it is just such a beautiful book. Her illustrations throughout this book are spectacular, and there will be things in here that you won't find on Cape Cod beaches. But she starts with a quote by Jacques Cousteau, "The sea, once it casts its spell, holds one in its net of wonder forever." And that certainly is true no matter which ocean you're at. She also writes, "Our varied and dynamic coastline offers some of the best places in the country to visit. So it is perhaps unsurprising that most of us have had a love affair with the seaside since our childhoods. We retain the potential to be surprised as adults when we return to seaside haunts of our youth and realize that there is not a rock pool, marsh, or dune that does not provide the perfect conditions for some living thing to thrive." So I think this book is wonderful in both its illustrations, in its projects. I haven't ever seen a book that includes a lot of seashore lore as well as projects, as well as recipes. It is called An Illustrated Coastal Year by Celia Lewis, and I recommend it highly.
All right. Dennis, what's your next book?
Well, my next book is The Outermost House. Mm-hmm. By Henry Beston. Again, foundational book, very important book, 1928, I believe. Henry Beston spent a year out on Coast Guard Beach by Nauset Marsh and so on. And it's very prescient. It's very prophetic in many ways. I read two versions, two introductions, one by my friend Philip Hoare. He describes it as a sand-born version of Walden, spending a year in a cabin. And our own Robert Finch points out in his introduction that this book, Rachel Carson considered it a major, major influence. And also, officials at Cape Cod National Seashore described it as a motivating force for the creation of Cape Cod National Seashore. So it is really an important book, and there's lots to be gained from it. Beston says, "The world today is sick to its thin blood for lack of elemental things, for fire before the hands, for water welling from the earth, for air, for the dear earth itself underfoot." And that was in 1928. He says, "The three great elemental sounds in nature are the sound of rain, the sound of wind in a primeval wood, and the sound of outer ocean on a beach." He says, "With lights and ever more lights, we drive the holiness and beauty of night back to the forests and the sea." So lots of lamenting civilization gobbling up our nature. He has one of the most often quoted but wisest comments on animals. He says, "We need another and a wiser and perhaps a more mystical concept of animals. They are not our brethren. They are not our underlings. They are other nations caught with ourselves in the net of life and time, fellow prisoners of the splendor and travail of the earth." So it's a beautiful book. He also talks a lot about the surf men. These are guys that have heard the roar of the surf about their cradles. And, he's very familiar with the Coast Guardsmen who are there. He observes a solitary swimmer and the beauty of the human form. "All my life it has given me pleasure to see beautiful human beings. To see beautiful young men and women gives one a kind of reverence for humanity. And surely there are few moods of the spirit more worthy of our care than those in which we reverence, even for a moment, our tragic and bewildered kind. So lots to think about here. Philip Hoare underscores the fact that he came back from World War I. He was an ambulance driver. He was much affected by the war, and that is sort of an understated part of this book, too, that nature is a healer. So my second classic, The Outermost House.
You're listening to The Point. We are talking about books that are set on or about the Cape Coast and Islands. With us this morning, Jill Erickson, reference librarian at Falmouth Public Library, and naturalist Dennis Minsky. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626 if you have a book you'd like to suggest for us. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. And Dana is giving us a call from Wellfleet. Hi, Dana.
Hi, good morning. Excuse me. Yes, I too am. I really am glad you're, you know, thank you for reminding me to revisit The Outermost House. I remember reading that for the first time during the blizzard of 78 when I lived in Burlington, Mass. And one thing I'd like to say about it, though, like, I think I missed something along the way. Was it Henry Beston or Philip Hoare that talked about the beauty of the human spirit and all that?
That was Beston.
I mean, you know.
Beston.
Okay, I'm really surprised he would say that. Apparently he wasn't aware of the hubris of our species that has pushed life to the brink of extinction, you know, other species to the brink of extinction with our arrogance and hubris. Mm-hmm. I'm really surprised. I really cringe when I hear that kind of talk.
Well,
I really
think if you read the entire book, you'll see a mix of attitudes. There's quite a bit about the impingement of civilization on nature.
Yeah.
It's a balance.
Yeah, Dana. All right. Dana, thanks for sharing your thoughts. We appreciate that. And if you have a book you'd like to suggest, we'd love to hear from you. 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. Jill, what's next?
Well, first I have to mention to Dennis that my partner, Matt, who I've been with for many years now, he first introduced me to The Outermost House, and he had learned about it because every summer his dad would move his lab to Woods Hole, and every night he would sit in the hallway of outside the kids' bedrooms and read them chapters of The Outermost House. So with his very young children, they got to hear The Outermost House, like every summer Phil would be reading The Outermost House to them. So it's a beautiful book. I have several poets here, as you will not be surprised to know. There are many, many poets, wonderful poets, who either lived on Cape Cod or currently live on Cape Cod. It is a writer's paradise, or the islands. There are also plenty of poets from Nantucket and the Vineyard. But, of course, the one that I'm picking is the one that is most dearest to the hearts of Falmouth residents because he graduated from Falmouth High School. He graduated in 1977, and he also taught a lot of kids in Falmouth Latin because he was a Latin teacher at Falmouth High School for a number of years, and that's Carl Phillips, who is now on, I believe, his 14th collection of poetry. And I will say that we've also, because, you know, this is what reference librarians do, we have actually digitized the entire Falmouth High School yearbook. So, you know, if you want to see Carl Phillips when he graduated from high school, this is possible. And I will say that I am happy to post my high school picture from my yearbook, seeing, you know, just so he's not the only one with a goofy photo out there. It is really, and may I just say, Carl, if you are listening, thanks for your tweet. We've been chatting a little bit back and forth, and one of the things he told me this morning, which I did not know, and nobody ever told me this, I don't know, but he worked at Falmouth Public Library for 3 years when he was in high school. So he was no doubt a shelver, which means when I'm touching some of those books, it means Carl Phillips had touched it. That's how old some of our books are in our collection. And, of course, his father used to come into the library all the time to tell us, oh, Carl's got a new book out. You got to buy it. So we're always prepared. But he also has written a really beautiful poem, which is the one I'm going to read this morning, which is from what I think is his most recent collection, Wild as the Wind. And it's called Monomoy. And Monomoy, for those of you that may just be visiting, is Monomoy Island, a spit of sand extending southwest from Chatham. Monomoy. Somewhere, people must still do things like fetch water from wells and buckets, then pour it out for those animals that, long domesticated, would likely perish before figuring out how to get for themselves. That dog, for example, whose refusal to leave my side I mistook as a child for loyalty when all along it was just blind. What is it about vulnerability that can make the hand draw back? Sometimes, and can sometimes seem the catalyst for rendering the hand into sheer force, destructive? Don't you see how you've burnt almost all of it, all the tenderness away, someone screams to someone else in public? And looking elsewhere, we walk quickly past, as if even to have heard that much might have put us at risk of whatever fate questions like that spring from. Estrangement, like sacrifice, begins as a word at first. Soon it's the stuff of drama. Cue the follow-up tears that attend drama. Then it's pretty much the difference between waking up to a storm and waking up inside one. Who can say how she got there? In the ocean, I mean. But I watched a horse make her way back to land mid-hurricane, having ridden surfer-like the very waves that at any moment could have overwhelmed her in their crash to shore. She shook herself, looked back once on the water's restlessness. History's always restless, and the horse stepped free. That's Monomoy by Carl Phillips.
Beautiful.
All right. Yeah, very nice. Let's talk to Rand, who's giving us a call from Orleans. Hi, Rand.
Oh, hello.
Yeah, go ahead.
I'm really enjoying this program and all the books recommended. I had to call in, but I don't have the book with me, so I can't quote from it. But it's by Lee Roscoe, who's a journalist and author on Cape Cod, playwright. The book was published in a small edition, I believe, so people will have to search for it. And I'm hoping someone might call in who has it, who could quote from it. But it's an extraordinary, it's called Walking Monomoy's Present, Dreaming Monomoy's Past. And it is historical, but it goes very, very deep only into Monomoy Island, and reflects, of course, on Cape Cod history and culture more broadly. But it talks about the people, but it really starts with the place in terms of its natural history. And it weaves in wonderful poetic reflections where history is filtered through a poetic imagination. So, for example, there are just extraordinarily beautiful passages trying to imagine how wonderful it would have been to have lived on the island when only the Wampanoag were present. And it describes their agriculture, their movement to the coastline from other parts of the Cape. They're just wonderful passages in this.
Yeah, it sounds lovely. Yeah. Rand, thanks for calling and suggesting that. We'll definitely put that on our list. Thank you for sharing.
Yeah. It might be hard to find. It might be in Cape Cod libraries.
I'm sure it will be.
Thanks for that. 866-999-4626 is our number if you'd like to suggest a book for our list. And we will have a link to all of the books we talk about at our website later today at capeandislands.org. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. All right, Dennis, what's your third classic?
Okay, my third classic We talked about Henry David Thoreau. We talked about Henry Beston. Come on, Robert Finch. Thoreau wrote about 3 weeks on Cape Cod. Henry Beston wrote about 1 year on Cape Cod. Our own Robert Finch has been writing for over 50 years about Cape Cod. He's got at least 10 books about the Cape. Of course, he's a regular on WCAI. He is a friend of mine. I can call him a mentor. And so I just picked, I think, if you don't know his work, if The Outer Beach, A Thousand-Mile Walk on Cape Cod's Atlantic Shore, came out, I think, in 90... it came out in 2017.
Yeah, I was going to say. It's more recent.
So what it is it is a Robert Finch sampler. You can pick the book up anywhere and read anything. It's a thousand-mile walk, but this is 40 years. He estimates he's walked over 1,000 miles in 40 years. And you get to see different Robert Finches. You get to see him at the age of 19 or 20, and you get to see him in his 60s. And he visits and revisits these places. He starts at Monomoy, which Jill just gave us a beautiful poem about. He describes Monomoy as a mere breath of land, the flicking end of a marine whip of tide and sand. And he marches all the way up to Long Point, which he describes as an elephantine trunk that seems to spin out endlessly, spiral upon spiral, its intricate weavery curving ever in upon itself, orienting the walker in a different direction with every step. And so you get all through the Outer Beach all the way. And the first thing I would like to say about Robert Finch's writing is it is so beautiful. Here are three descriptions that I gleaned from separate parts of the book of fog. The fog lifted like a silver cover off a main dish platter. You had seen that this morning, actually. Another one. The fog has poured nearly continuously over this naked beach like some great silent river. And then another one, the fog is a great gray god. It's just beautiful. He talks about waves with foam-laced fingers. He describes the gannets closing their streamlined bodies like umbrellas and plunging like javelins into the dark sea. He describes the beach in the evening likened to the piece of a classroom just emptied. Beautiful image. He describes the beach buggy headlights at night lurching drunkenly. Anybody that's been on the beach seen that. But he also there's so much wisdom in this book. He talks about the rack line, Jill, and he says it may be viewed as miniature reenactment in both dimension and time scale of the terminal moraines left by the retreating glaciers. So, you know, every tide acts like the glaciers, and the way that the Cape was formed, that's how the beach is formed every day. I mean, I'm paraphrasing. I don't really do it justice. But just a lot of wisdom here. There's a lot of poetry. And then finally, I think a very wise thing for those of us who are nature lovers, he has one section called A Quickie at the Beach. Not what you think. but he's on the way to a movie or something. He says, I'll just stop by and experience the beach. This is Marconi Beach. And he says, but it didn't cooperate. The earth, I think, closes in on itself when we do not give it our full attention. When, for instance, we're still savoring a big meal and looking forward to mindless entertainment. The beach refuses to be a preview. So what I get from that is pay attention, you know? When you go to the beach or the woods or the dunes or wherever you are, or even downtown, pay attention. Give it your full attention, and you will be repaid. So Robert Finch is is foundational. That's all I can say about him.
His observations are just beautiful. You're right. He's a beautiful writer. Thanks for bringing that, Dennis, this morning. Let's talk to Caleb, who is calling from Mashpee. Hi, Caleb.
Hi, good morning. I was really glad to hear that you guys, first off, I did just purchase the field guide to Cape Cod. It sounds pretty amazing. So thanks for pointing that out.
That's great.
But I was glad that you guys also mentioned Cape Cod, because I'd seen the book sitting on the shelf for many years here, and I'm up here all summer now because we're sort of working abroad or working from home. And I was struck with the way he describes Thoreau does some of the people. He's not a very nice man. When he's talking about his regard for the truth, obliges us to say that the few women who we saw that day looked exceedingly pinched up. They had prominent chins and noses, having lost all their teeth. A sharp W would represent their profile. They were not so well-preserved as their husbands, or perchance they were well-preserved as dried specimens. Their husbands, however, were pickled. But we respect them not the less for all that. Our own dental system is far from perfect. And I was also really intrigued about who this companion was. And there's a great article that if anyone wants to look up, it's from the late 70s in the New York Times, and it talks about William Eller Channing, mm-hmm. who was his travel companion, who they describe as everything Thoreau was not, impractical, disorganized, amenable. So I think the two of them climbing up the beach together, you know, with their very different personalities is something that I like to think back on and know that, you know, that beach is still there.
Yeah. Yeah, Caleb, thanks for calling and sharing your thoughts. We appreciate that. And enjoy your summer in Mashpee. You're listening to The Point. We are talking about books set on or about the Cape Coast and Islands. 866-999-4626 is our number if you have a suggestion for us. Or you can shoot us an email, thepoint@capeandislands.org. With us is Jill Erickson, reference librarian at Falmouth Public Library, and naturalist Dennis Minsky. Jill, what's next on your list?
Well, the next book I have is really fascinating, and I wish it came out. It was also published in a small edition, and I wish this was a book that they would, some big publisher will pick up and publish everywhere. It's called Seaweed's Revelation, A Wampanoag Clan Mother in Contemporary America by Amelia G. Bingham. And it is, in the review, Barnstable Patriot did a really great review on this book, and they write, Amelia Bingham's book, Seaweed's Revelation, is one of the best I have read on the Wampanoag. A respected elder, she writes with clarity, force, and honesty. This is no holds barred tell-all about the frustrating factions in the tribe, including conflicts in her own family that may have held back earlier federal recognition for the Wampanoag Nation, finally gained in 2007, and as we know recently, they tried to take it away, but they didn't. Mm-hmm. Bingham was instrumental in bringing tribal claims to the attention of the U.S. government. She researched state archives and documents going back to the 1600s. She uncovered a long thread of persecution, such as Wampanoags not allowed to speak their language or learn to write on pain of death to those who might teach them, and not surprisingly, land theft for hundreds of years in spite of the 18th century Indian Non-Intercourse Act. And she goes on to say the book is not just about Bingham as a mixed-race Native American. What makes it terrific is the story of her life, married to a mixed-race black career army officer who was also chief of the police of Mashpee, traveling and living in Europe, where she first discovered pride in her heritage, raising a family of eight, living through war times and the changes from a simple rural life filled with great pleasures by the ocean, as well as grueling work, to one with electricity, automobiles, and sophistication. There are wonderful anecdotes. She swam with JFK as a child and was entertained by such luminaries as jazz singer Dinah Washington as an adult. And she begins her introduction, Amelia begins her introduction saying, I am a Mashpee Wampanoag, one of an Eastern Native American tribe of people that traces its lineage back 10,000 years. Through all these centuries, we Wampanoags have inhabited our ancestral homeland, land now known as Cape Cod, Nantucket, and Martha's Vineyard, Massachusetts. Living so close to the ocean, my ancestors became renowned for their skills as fishermen. But primarily, we Wampanoags are known for one single episode in our long history. We are the tribe that greeted the passengers of that famous English ship, the Mayflower, which landed at Plymouth Rock in 1620. We gave them food and taught them how to survive in their new world. We are the Indians who sat down to feast with the pilgrims at the first Thanksgiving. So that's how she begins it, and it's really just fascinating, both about her life as a Wampanoag and life in on Cape Cod and in Mashpee. And it is really a great read. It again, I wish some big publisher would pick it up and send it out to the world. It's Seaweed's Revelation, A Wampanoag Clan Mother in Contemporary America by Amelia Bingham.
Ooh, thanks, Jill. Mary is giving us a call from Eastham. Good morning, Mary.
Good morning. I'd like to, I'm glad to hear that someone was bringing up the Wampanoag, because that's exactly what I wanted to talk about. Was a book I read a while ago, and I know most of it takes part in other parts of Massachusetts, but it does take place on the Cape as well, and it's about King Philip's War. And the name of it is Flintlock and Tomahawk, although I cannot remember the author. I know you can look it up.
Mm-hmm. What was the name of the book again?
The name of the book is Flintlock and Tomahawk, and it is about King Philip's War in the 1600s of the Wampanoag tribe. And it is really fascinating.
Great. We'll put that on the list, and we'll look up who the author is. Mary, thank you. Thanks for suggesting.
I wanted to mention one more thing about it. As I was reading it, when they were talking about the laws that were implemented during King Philip's War, the Native Americans, the Mashpee, Wampanoag, as well as other Indians, were not allowed to gather in more than groups of 10 because there was a concern about an insurrection. And there was a nursery rhyme that I remember as a child. Always, it was one little, two little, three little Indians, which a lot of us might remember. Mm-hmm. And then it would only go up to 10. And that's where that comes from.
Interesting. Yeah. Thanks, Mary. Thanks
for read about the war.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for calling with that. Well, we appreciate that.
Okay,
we've
cool.
got an email. Yeah, thank you for calling. We have an email from Fritz in Kituit who says, I would like to be sure to mention crab wars about horseshoe crabs, which has remained current due to the current research with COVID, and also a mystery by George Foy, Asia Rip, in which the protagonist must escape and return to the Cape while the state police are monitoring the bridges. Good fun. And we should mention Crab Wars. It's a tale of horseshoe crabs, bioterrorism, and human health by Bill Sargent. An excellent book. Thank you for suggesting that. That is great. Dennis, what's next?
Before, I just want to mention the earlier caller said that beach was still there. Actually, the beach that Thoreau walked is at least 100 yards out to sea. We should mention there has been a bit of erosion in the last 100 and whatever years.
A little bit, yeah.
the next, but you get the same feel. The next book I would talk about is called A Wild Rank Place, 1 Year on Cape Cod by David Gessner, G-E-S-S-N-E-R. Of course, he takes the title from the passage that I read earlier from Thoreau. And the entire book is him doing his quote-unquote Thoreau thing. This is a very personal book, as are all the books I've mentioned. Gessner is from Colorado, but he grew up on the Cape, and he's dealing with cancer. He's dealing with the death of his father, and he's just holed up for a year dealing with life, and he's doing it in East Dennis, Sesuit. Mm-hmm. So the first thing that he quite honestly says, how hard it is to write about Cape Cod. The fact is Thoreau and others, including Robert Finch, have permanently altered what I see. Their quotes are as much a part of the landscape as the bayberry bushes, and I can't consciously uneducate myself. My adventure is imaginatively filled by adventures past, my life here partly plagiarism. how much does my knowledge of Thoreau alone in his cabin inform my time in my own? How much of my love of this place was born of books? I'm left with a small and silly self-portrait. Here I sit in my tamed, wild place. I live alone in a book-filled cabin, talking to ghosts, trying to live a year in the woods at this late date on this overwritten and contaminated ground. And a little bit more about the contaminated. He says, Thoreau's Cape was wild, but today much of that wilderness is covered with video stores and malls. This is a bit hyperbole, I believe. It is easy to forget the crowded roads and beaches, the polluted aquifer, the jet skis retching into the water, the high cancer rates on the Upper Cape, the coming outfall pipe promising feces on the beach. Certainly it's easy enough to get depressed. Just picture the cars, more and more each summer, crawling across the bridge from Boston, New York City, and points beyond, or the mobs of children who grew up spending summers here and will soon build houses of their own. You know, we're a little like rabbits I see on the lawn, their land crisscrossed by roads, forcing them into smaller and smaller patches of wilderness. But, you know, so it's a love-hate thing he's got here. But he does love Cape Cod. He talks about Thoreau called my town, Dennis, exceedingly barren and desolate country. He says, there were deer here once, Thoreau said. There were deer here once. Well, now we have plenty of deer. Despite all the development, in some ways, today's Cape is closer to what we consider wild than Thoreau's. This is a really moving, rough, sometimes you know, there are unpleasant patches, but he's quite a guy. One interesting image that I got out of this that we talked about the Wampanoags, he makes reference to how Martha's Vineyard and Nantucket were formed. According to the Wampanoags, and that is that Malshop, which was the giant, I guess he was a god, emptied the sand out of his moccasins. And hence we have Martha's Vineyard in Nantucket. I like that image very much. Not sure it's true, but I like it.
Yeah, what's the title of the book again?
A Wild Rank Place, 1 Year on Cape Cod. Gessner, G-E-S-S-N-E-R, yeah. David Gessner.
You know, I've read several of his books. I like his writing. I think he's a very good writer. Yeah, I don't think I've read that one, but I've read some of his other ones.
Yeah,
Gail in East Orleans writes, not natural history, but for anyone missing Cape League baseball this summer, pick up a copy of The Last Best League by Jim Collins. It follows the Chatham Anglers through a season. It's a great read for baseball lovers in general, and particularly fans of the Cape League. It came out a few years back. Gail, thank you. That's a great suggestion. I know there are a lot of folks who are missing Cape League baseball this summer. Jill, what have you got?
Well, I came across this book because it was on a weeding cart, and we still are weeding, even though, you know, the building is closed, but the library's opened. I thought, how could this used to be such a popular book? Why is this on the weeding list? And it's because nobody had checked it out for years and years. So I checked it out because I had never read anything, as far as I know, by Henry Beadle Huff. And this book is called To the Harbor Light, which he wrote in his 79th year, and I was completely charmed by it. I think his writing is so beautiful. I can't believe I've never read it before, but in any case, just to give you an idea of the kind of, I mean, it's hard to explain how much I fell in love with this book. Okay, here's a little bit. I fell in yesterday with my neighbor Milton Birch, and we walked along our lane together, not hurrying at all in the warm morning sunlight. We both live alone, according to the town's opinion, but he has no dog, and this accounts for a great difference. I've just hung out my wash on the line, Milton said. Only a few people have clotheslines anymore, but I don't like a dryer. If you dry your wash outdoors, it smells entirely different. Did you ever dry any wash on Chappaquiddick? No, I said. Well, I don't suppose you ever had occasion to, but it smells entirely different over there when the wild roses are blooming and the breeze comes fresh over the water and then across those fields it goes all through the clothes on the line and they smell wonderful. As somebody who likes to hang her clothes out outside, I particularly love that. Here's another little bit, and his dog's name is Graham, and Graham is a big character in this book. While summer was still with us, Graham and I went for a walk in the evening, and somehow one of the fireflies of the darkness along the path around Sheriff's Meadow Pond became positioned in Graham's ruff. Somehow is a word of explanation, or more rightly, of non-explanation, for things that nature, not even contriving, allows to happen all by themselves. Nature is easygoing, and often at her best in a starlit and firefly-lit summer night at Sheriff's Meadow. I mean, it's just full of these little moments of life, and I think right now we are all paying attention to these little moments of life. And so I really highly recommend. There's also stuff in here about North Falmouth as well as the vineyard. It's called To the Harbor Light by Henry Beadle Huff. And for those of you that may not know, Henry Beadle Huff was the editor of the Vineyard Gazette for over 50 years.
Yep, yep. All right, Dennis.
Sounds good. My next book is called The Salt House. You might see a kind of a theme here. The Salt House, A Summer on the Dunes of Cape Cod. The author is Cynthia Huntington. And this is a description of her staying in the dunes in a shack called Euphoria, where I've spent four or five I've been out there four or five times. At any rate, anybody who has been out in the dunes will enjoy this book. And anyone who has not been out in the dunes overnight, this book is as close as you can get to it without getting sand in your shoes. she writes that for three summers, I lived with my husband, Bert Yarborough, on the back shore of Cape Cod, in a dune shack 200 yards above the beach on land owned by the National Park Service. Dune shack is the local and by no means disparaging term for a certain generation of beach cottages set along the two-mile dune ridge that runs between Race Point and Provincetown and High Head in North Truro. She says, these pages offer a sort of calendar of our life there, a life that was simple and spare, though never far removed from what we call civilization, in a place of such wild, austere beauty that at first I had no words for its spaces, its dusty heat, the thrilling clarity of its air. Only gradually was I able to take it into myself and let it remake me. My memories of those days are salt, clean and sharp, days of light and water, salt air, the salt white dunes, the bite of seawater on my skin. Years later, I carry them all in my body, distilled in memory and circulated in the blood. And I'm sure as Jill is doing, you want to find the right passage. Virtually anywhere I open this book is just sheer bliss. She describes what was ours was all around us, touching every sense, glittering beach grasses and the crying of the terns from dawn till midday, the light and empty spaces of the dunes and the pale line of beach stretching off to the horizon.
All right, we have to leave it there, Dennis. We are out of time. We will have a link to the books we talked about at our website later today at capeandislands.org. Dennis Minsky, Jill Erickson, thanks so much for joining us. I'm Mindy Todd. Thank you for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.